Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, setting yourself up for a good death can start decades before you expect to die. We'll spend this hour with journalist Katie Butler, who says we can lay the groundwork for spending the end of our lives the way we wish by taking good care of our bodies, brains, and relationships. We'll talk about the medical procedures and screening tests very old people might be better off without, about how we can ensure we or our loved ones are kept comfortable but not over-medicated, and we will get some ideas for honoring death as a sacred experience, whether it happens at home or in a healthcare facility. Our conversation starts after a short break. Live to be 65. Actuaries say you have a 50-50 chance of living another couple of decades into your early to mid 80s. That's good news, right? On the other hand, it does give many of us the impression we can put off giving much thought to how we'll die, maybe for decades, depending on how old we are now. But if you hope to stay happy and relatively healthy for most of the years ahead and to die with no regrets, it is never too early to get started. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The new book by journalist Katie Butler is called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. She was in her late 50s when her father died, 6 years after the installation of a pacemaker that kept his heart beating for years after his eyes, his ears, and his brain had worn out. Medical science was able to keep him alive, but it failed to preserve the quality of his life. Lots of people don't want to be around beyond the point at which we're truly living, however we define that for ourselves. And as Butler has learned, there are lots of things we can do to prolong those years of living and reduce the time we spend dying. And the earlier we start planning for the end of our lives, the more control and dignity we might be able to have. Katie, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm really happy to be here.
How has the process of dying changed in the modern era from what it had been for most of our history?
For most of our history, dying took place fairly rapidly, usually at home, and usually framed as a spiritual ordeal rather than a medical event. But since about 1900, and especially since the 1950s, we now have created a gray zone between active living and active dying. And that gray zone, which used to be maybe a few weeks, perhaps a month or two, can now be years or even decades. Because of the very success of our medicine, which I would never want to take away from, we can now prolong the process of aging and dying, which has created a peculiar shape to modern death, peculiar problems that are associated with modern death.
There's a phrase
It's become medicalized and also moved into the hospital, delegated to medicine to manage, and often as a result, stripped of meaning, stripped of humanity or dignity, and stripped of what I call a sense of the sacred.
Hmm. And you say that aggressive treatment of a dying person often doesn't stop now until, in your words, someone gathers the courage to say no.
Yes, and I think those of us who are outside the healthcare system don't realize this. People sign advance directives, but if you have a family in conflict or someone who flies in from the last minute from elsewhere in the country and says, "Doc, do everything," often people in the medical system are so afraid of bad reviews or being sued that treatment will continue until the whole family comes to consensus and says it's time to stop. And sometimes you see the same conflicts within a medical team. You may have a palliative care doctor who is trying to get the family used to the idea that really death is on its way, while you have a nephrologist or an oncologist who's insisting, let's give it one more try. And so people often become victims of this lack of consensus and this terror of accepting the reality of death. And a lot of doctors don't even have the language. They don't even have a way to say to you, your mom is approaching the end of her life. I don't know exactly when. I don't know exactly how. But she's in the house of cards now. The tiniest thing could push her over the edge. We've lost that kitchen table language, and instead we often face medical people who are talking to us in ways that we just can't understand because it's so technical. I bet a lot of your listeners have felt that sense of being somewhat at sea in the middle of a medical crisis.
It's such a strange turnaround, Katie, because for most of our lives, until we reach the period that will be the end of our lives, whether because of a severe illness or because we are at an advanced age, suddenly, like, there's this shift in how we're supposed to relate to medicine, right? Because before that, as a young person, typically, you do pull out all the stops and hope to restore someone to health. And then there becomes a point where no matter what is done, you're not going to keep someone healthy and alive.
That's right. And in fact, you actually start exposing people to additional risks. Mm. There's a phrase in medicine called polypharmacy. That means being on way too many drugs that are creating way too many side effects and actually diminishing your ability to function. And that's just one example.
You're targeting this. Go ahead, please continue.
Yeah. When you're young, your body's strong, you're resilient. You can go in for a major surgery. You can survive a terrible car accident. And we've developed a form of medicine that I call in the book fast medicine. It's sort of like the equivalent of fast foods. Mm-hmm. You throw a lot of interventions fast at someone. You can save their lives in a way that you never could in the 1950s or earlier. But in the book, I detail 7 different phases to our decline, the last third of our lives, starting really in our early 50s, where we start to lose this resilience. And then we seem to have more and more interventions offered to us, but they do less and less good. And there comes a point where they actually do harm. In the book, I talk about this house of cards stage, where you may have multiple small or big health problems, and they're all adding up to this picture of frailty. And then something like a heart surgery can create so much cognitive decline that somebody has to enter a nursing home. Our muscle, I hate to go into all this, but our muscles wither very much more quickly. So even the stress of being in a hospital and just lying in bed for 3 days may be enough for some people to destroy their ability to get up out of a chair. And then that will kick off a period of prolonged disability that ends in death. Yeah. So I'm a big fan of a movement called slow medicine, which is medicine that favors and honors relationship and time and thoughtful interventions, where realizing that doing more is not necessarily doing better. And I think this is a very important change. For some people, it comes in their 50s if they have multiple serious health problems or someone with cancer. Later in life, it could be your 70s or 80s. And of course, some people prolong their period of resilience greatly because they exercise and they take good care of themselves.
Yeah, you really encourage us to think of eating right, sleeping right, exercising, avoiding drugs and alcohol, as forms of medicine that we don't have to pay for.
Yes, exactly. A lot of the 5-cent solutions that require a lot more of us than of medicine are actually going to have the greatest impact. 80% of your health status is mostly your lifestyle. 20% of it is the quality of the medical care you receive. So start with requires the most of you and the least of medicine. And my favorite is 30 minutes of vigorous exercise a day. If people made only one change and that was it, that would have the most major impact on not just their current health and not just the fact that you feel better if you exercise, but actually, what is this future going to look like? A lot of us have seen these long periods of prolonged decline in people that we love very dearly. And if we want to truncate that period, make it as short as possible so that we have this Niagara Falls trajectory where you maintain a high quality of life as long as possible and then a fairly quick decline, 30 minutes of vigorous exercise is the number one. But a lot of us have heard all this. We've heard it repeatedly. And I think, again, think of this as medicine, which is group support. The Y, for example, has a pre-diabetes class. And people get group support in that situation to make these very difficult lifestyle changes because we've all been told, you know, eat better, get more exercise. But if we don't have some kind of group support, we're unlikely to be able to actually continue with those changes.
I don't know that a lot of people think about the importance of social relationships as something that plays into their health. But there's a growing amount of evidence that, in fact, it's really important that we have ongoing, meaningful contact with other people.
Exactly. On the simplest level, loneliness and isolation are health risks. They increase your risk of dementia. And on a more practical level, if you know your neighbors and something's wrong or your paper doesn't get taken in, someone's going to come over and knock on the door or give you a ride to get a pharmacy prescription filled. So I think we need as much as we can to rebuild these connections. And there's a lot of research that it's not only the strong connections, like having a spouse or a roommate or a very dear friend. Those are very, very important connections. But it's also just the barista at Starbucks. It's the neighbor that you just say hi to every morning. My next door neighbor's 88, and he has a big box of dog treats at his open garage where he has a workshop. So every single neighbor who goes by with a dog, he feeds that dog and gets to know that neighbor, which means he has a whole network of social support if and when. He's actually really healthy at 88, but if and when he has some health crisis, a lot of us already know him and we'll be there to help.
What do you suggest to people who take an honest look at their lives and realize they don't have a lot of strong bonds?
It's a very difficult situation. We live in a society where more and more people live alone in a way that they never did in prior generations. People travel. People move far away from where they grew up, so they're not even close to their extended families. This is a huge national problem, which I wish I could just, like, solve. I encourage people to do things like join groups. Figure out a tribe. Figure out what your passion is in life and find a group that you can do it with. It doesn't matter if it's quilters or motorcyclists or members of the junior league. It can be any kind of social group, bowling group. But as long as you can get together face to face, there's a real problem with thinking that because we're on Facebook and we exchange messages with people that we don't know, that we have a community. It's really an illusion. So get in at the shallow end of the pool, you know, join a choir, take a class at one of the extension programs. Look for people who have similar passions to you. Because actually, what I found, I interviewed hundreds of people for the book about good and difficult deaths that they had in some ways helped someone or witnessed in some way, including a lot of people in the medical field. And what I found is that you need, if you want to die well at home, you need one passionate friend who will really take ownership. But you also need a tribe of people who will just do the little things. Come in for 20 minutes, bring you a dinner, drive you to a meeting. All of these things will make an enormous difference. So find your tribe somewhere. And, you know, if nothing else, I mean, again, I think we've been told that it's good to have friends and social networks. But if nothing else, it's going to make those last two decades of your life so much more enjoyable, so much less frightened, and really help you have meaning and joy and comfort as you approach these years of decline.
My guest is journalist Katie Butler. We're talking about her book, The Art of Dying Well, a practical guide to a good end of life. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink. We'll be right back. listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist Katie Butler about her book, The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. I was really interested, Katie, in reading about the ways that some people rethink the healthcare that they receive, where they receive it, from whom they receive it, as they move into their 60s and 70s and 80s. One tip that you have is if you are that age and your doctor is your age or older, you might want to look around for someone else. Explain that.
Well, you don't want to be in a very vulnerable older stage of your life when just getting through the day might be difficult. You don't want to be trying to form a bond with somebody at that late stage. And there are some practical reasons. Older patients are very time-consuming, and frankly, a lot of doctors don't want to take them on. But if you've already created a deep bond with a doctor, it's very different. He's or she is likely, much more likely to stick with you through this time when you become a very expensive patient to them, frankly. We have some terrible aspects to our medical reimbursement system, which is that if you put a technology into somebody, it's very well paid. If you take time, more than 15 minutes with a patient, you're not going to be so well paid. You're going to be paid $50, maybe $100 instead of several thousand. So if you have a complicated older patient who's on multiple meds, maybe has three different major health problems, you really need to take time to look at the big picture there, and that is not well reimbursed. So geriatricians are very good if you can find them. They're experts in late life medicine, but they're few and far between because they are so poorly paid. Another problem is just fragmentation in the medical system. We've accumulated all of these experts, all of these ologists, and often none of them have the big picture. So it's at the very time when it's most important to have coordinated healthcare, you're likely to have very discoordinated, fragmented healthcare.
You say that for some people, moving into a concierge medical practice can be useful.
Yes, that's if you can afford it, this is a great way to go. These are doctors who want, it sounds kind of snooty for a lot of people, but it really isn't. These are doctors with their hearts in the right place. They want to take adequate time with patients, and the reimbursement system isn't set up for it. So for anything ranging from a couple hundred dollars a year to actually several thousand a month, depending on your income level and the kind of services you want, you get a doctor who can return your call right away or will make a house call, perhaps. You get the time that you need rather than the technology that you often don't need. Another way people can get these kind of services if you don't have a lot of money is a program called PACE, which is the program of, I think it's advanced care for the elderly, all-inclusive care for the elderly. There are some government programs that fund, for example, nurse house call service or physician house call services. And these can be very, very useful add-ons as well. And if you've got the money, they can be extremely helpful and they're worth paying out of pocket.
I want to talk about a section of your book that might surprise people because many of us are in the habit of going through whatever screening or testing our doctors recommend. Why might we want to rethink some of that or even push back as we move into what is sometimes called old age?
There's a great website called Thinking Wisely. I'm sorry. I'll come back to it. Essentially, you only want medical care that actually either makes you better or at least doesn't do any harm. For example, prostate cancer screening. For people who don't have an elevated risk of that, screening can show a high PSA level, which creates panic, anxiety, and sometimes unnecessary surgery, which can create incontinence and impotence. None of these are things that are high on anybody's list for a high quality of life. Older men often die with prostate cancer rather than of prostate cancer. But if you've got that screening and you see that high level, you may panic. So that's one that I really don't recommend.
So I think a lot of us trust our doctors to help us make these decisions. On the other hand, it's like asking someone who's at a car dealership, will this car, you know, get me around better than the car I'm in now? They have a financial incentive to say yes. So how do we know, you know, when the expert is recommending something that may or may not ultimately be the best thing for us?
Well, that website is called Choosing Wisely.
Okay.
So that's one place to look. That's where there's a consensus of certain things that are just too much, not helpful, or the risks are too great. Another obvious one is, like, it's a very difficult thing. I think we've got to learn to speak up with our doctors, to find our voices and keep our voices and talk in ordinary kitchen table language with them. So what will happen if we don't do this? What will happen if we just watch and wait? What are the pros, cons, and alternatives to what you're suggesting? These are the kind of questions I think we have to learn to just speak up and raise with doctors, because unfortunately, our medical system has been shaped very heavily by major lobbies in Washington, especially for medical device companies and for big pharma. The result is medical reimbursements that are very, very advantageous to those markets and those corporations, but don't necessarily serve the end user. Could I give you an example?
Sure.
Very few people know that doctors who are oncologists are paid mostly by a markup on the price of the chemotherapy that they administer.
Hmm.
Now, this markup, which is 4.8%, I believe, right now, that means that creates a financial incentive to prescribe chemo as long as possible, even when it's no longer helpful, and it even creates an incentive for the most expensive chemo. Now, I'm not saying that doctors are venal, but the fact is that these incentives and disincentives do shape behavior. It would be much, much better if we paid oncologists really well for the time they need to put in to explain to people where they are on this trajectory from life to death. After the third round of chemo or treatment, the fourth round, statistically, only statistically, is a wash. It's no better than no treatment at all. And at that point, it's really much better for people to have conversations about, what does a good death look like to me? Where do I want to die? Is it important to me to die at home? How can I maintain the highest possible quality of life as long as possible? Because a lot of these treatments, as you know, have horrendous side effects. And if they're not benefiting us, we really have a right, and a moral right, a legal right, to refuse them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Venkap in Dallas. Hi, Venkap.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. So my question to Katie is, I want to talk about less is more. How can people at the end of their lives, rather than being dependent on this capitalistic healthcare system, be more reliant on community and family and, you know, have a safe journey wherever they need to go, but rather than depending on chemo and all those drugs? You know, is there any thought process towards that, rather than being dependent on a medical system, but being self-reliant and healthcare, less healthcare, if you will.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, I think it's an important question. I think, first of all, we need to be discerning, because there are certain treatments that will get us a great deal of benefit. I have a friend on immunotherapy right now. He's doing absolutely great. Cataract surgery will extend your period of non-disability. So with hip surgery, same thing, hip replacement. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here, but I think my advice is to start by imagining what a good death would look like to you and work back from there. If you want to die at home, what's it going to require for you to die well at home? I think we need to reduce people's panic and ignorance about the process of aging, declining, and dying, by really getting a good look at what it looks like and what we're going to need, what kind of support we're going to need. Because you can't expect people to reject last-ditch Hail Mary surgeries if they are sort of staring into the void with no sense of what might make that experience go well, or even be a sacred experience, a dignified experience, a rite of passage. So I think we need to be able to ask doctors, what's it like to die of my disease? And what can you do to help me with those symptoms? Because there's a great deal we can do now to help people with pain or breathlessness. Various diseases have different kind of signature ways of decline. And we got to speak up and ask questions.
I want to talk about the stage in anyone's life when we begin to experience frailty, falls, dizzy spells, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You say we don't necessarily need to run to the emergency room every time something happens. Can you talk a little bit about what we can think about in these situations?
Yes, there's an enormous gap in the health care system. It's the gap between being qualified for hospice and being in this earlier stage, this frail stage that I call House of Cards. Mm. In my book, there's a story of one guy who goes in and out of the ER, the emergency room, the nursing home, 9 times in his last year of life. And this is a guy with resources and a very devoted daughter. Some people feel like any time an old person gets dizzy or has a minor fall, they should be rushed to the ER by ambulance, costing the system about $6,000 or more, and then be run through a CAT scan and a million other tests. Often, it's nothing more than a bad reaction to too much blood pressure medication or not drinking enough water, being dehydrated. If you don't have the kind of thing that an emergency room does really well with, like a broken bone, terrible bleeding, high fever, symptoms of stroke, if that's not what's going on, I would really suggest just taking a pause, taking a breather, drinking a lot of water, and then maybe going to an emergency, urgent care. Going to urgent care. Again, we need to bring back the physician house call. We need to bring back the nursing house call. Finding a non-emergency way of taking a look in a calm situation to what's going on. Because the reality is when these older people show up in the ERs, they're not high priority. They sit there for hours. The environment is confusing and loud and noisy and bright lights. If they get hospitalized, even for 3 days, they may be kicked into a status called hospital delirium. It's a state of confusion and hallucinations. It actually contributes and makes dementia worse. And some people just never bounce back from a episode of hospital delirium.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Lots of people would prefer, as you said, to remain home and hire a health aide or an assistant to help out with that. I want to stipulate here that you and I both understand not everyone is in a financial position to do this, but your family had good luck finding caregivers without using an agency. Can you talk about the benefits of that and why you made that choice?
Sure. And just to address that financial point, people on Medicaid can get some home health aid. So there are some benefits but not nearly enough. What we did is I actually did it from the West Coast while my family was on the East Coast, which is we hired people off Craigslist and we paid them double the going rate, which is about exactly the same as what we would have paid an agency. And as a result, we had much, much more flexibility. We had 2 amazing people. One of them simply came in to put my father to bed at night because by then my mother was exhausted and short-tempered and not at her best. So she just came in for an hour and a half, but we paid her very decently for her hour and a half. And it took such a burden off my mother. The other person, actually, we got through a family network. She was a friend of my brother's. She had had a very difficult past, but she was in Alcoholics Anonymous. She was sober and had been sober for years. And she really became like a surrogate sister to me. But we treated her really well because I don't think we can expect people to do this deep soul work, and they can be so valuable when we're actually not treating them well.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Chris is on the line in Richardson, Texas. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Good afternoon. I am a high school English teacher, and I observed several years ago that any good piece of literature I'm teaching is going to deal with death and is going to, in some ways, hopefully help people think more clearly about it and to be more humane and more wise in their thoughts about it. First on my list, of course, is Margaret Edson's beautiful play, Wit, from the 1990s,
Oh, yeah.
Which takes place in a cancer ward. And which, of course, also, you know, deals with the poetry of John Donne, which is an extraordinarily eloquent treatment of death in itself. So I just wonder if you have done any research or had any observations of ways in which literary study or the liberal arts, the humanities, might enrich the experience of serious illness and or help people to face the looming experience of death.
Thanks for calling.
What a beautiful question. I feel that the great literature has an eloquence about these issues that seems to have been stripped away from medicine. I mean, medicine is trying very hard to put it back in. But Chekhov, for example, beautiful short stories by Chekhov about this. I also highly recommend the movie of Wit, which is just fabulous, and also a movie called Departures, which is the story of a Japanese coffin man, a guy who puts people into their coffins in Japan. These are both beautiful, eloquent pieces of art that give voice to the deeper concerns we have as we approach this difficult period of dying.
My guest is journalist Katie Butler. Her book is The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd speaking with journalist Katie Butler about her book, The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Katie, what is the work of dying for the person whose life is coming to an end?
Chris, I just wanted to follow up first on that last caller. I think our religious traditions have also always helped us prepare for this period of life. Mm. In Buddhism, there's a chant of, there's nothing I can do to prevent growing old. Judaism says man is like the grass that withers, the flower that fades. Every tradition has really encouraged us to stay in touch with this reality. So the work of dying, I think, is emotional and spiritual more than it is, and to some degree physical, more than it is technical or medical. A lot of people intuitively complete certain emotional tasks, and they are, thank you, I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and then finally, goodbye. In my book, I have a story of a woman whose mother's dying of cancer. They had a terrible relationship. Her mother had been a violent alcoholic. She flies in at the last moment. She sees her mother lying in bed. And the mother looks at her and just says, I love you and I'm sorry. And the daughter says back, I love you and I'm sorry.
Hmm.
And the daughter says that healed a lifetime of misunderstanding each other. You should never underestimate the power of your emotional legacy, because even though we may die, we live on in the memories and emotions of other people. And completing these tasks, giving yourself enough time to complete these tasks, not being so terrified of death or so convinced that you're a fighter and you're going to beat it. If you can let go of that perspective and turn toward your emotional legacy, you can make an enormous difference for the people who come after you.
I think a lot of people have had the experience of going into what turns out to be the final illness of their loved one, and being urged to accept help with eating or breathing or kidney function or heart rhythm when that person's in a terrible state of health overall. You call these double-edged sword treatments. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, they're often called halfway technologies because they can stop you from dying, but they can't make you, they can't make you happy again. They can't make you function better. They cannot restore you to a life of health or enjoyment or anything that you consider a good quality of life. They're very, of course, they all have their place. When somebody's got a temporary problem, they're a bridge technology until that person can recover enough function. But when you're in this globally fragile state, they often do more harm than good. And I think it's very important to remember that you have the legal, the moral, the medical right to reject any form of medical treatment for any reason at any time. You're not obligated to keep yourself alive longer than you're happy. And of course, some of these decisions fall to family members, which is why it is important to talk about what quality of life means to you ahead of time, so you don't leave them ridden with guilt and these very, very difficult decisions. You don't want them kind of stumbling around in the dark in the middle of a crisis.
Almost no one will say they want to die in a hospital or that they want their loved one to die in a hospital. Sometimes, often, that's the way it works out. Can you talk about some ways that you've learned to help make that experience peaceful and sacred, even if it's not in the environment that is ideal?
Ask to have all telemetry taken out of the room. Turn off all those beepers. Mm-hmm. Ask them to stop taking vital signs. There's absolutely no need. You can bring in a little battery-operated candle. It truly creates a sacred feeling. A vase of flowers, maybe a photograph of that person. Ask for a private room if you can. It's terrible to be dying in a room with somebody blasting the television in the next bed. You may not get everything, but you can ask. In the book, I have a story of a man who's dying in a terrible, dark, windowless ICU with all these bleepers and bloopers going. And his friends get together and they ask the ICU nurse, "Can we move him outside? I think he would want music and fresh air." And the nurse says, "Well, we can't move him outside, but we've got a better room that's opening up that has fresh air and windows that open to the outside." So when he's extubated, they take the tubes out, they take the lines out. He's moved into this much more beautiful space. And his friends gather around his bed. They've got his iPod. They cue up his playlist. They bring up little speakers from downstairs, and they play music that he loves as he's dying, and they all have their hands on his body. So it's not an ideal situation by any means, but it can be made a lot better. So don't be afraid to sort of take command of the space. Don't be afraid to ask for what you need. That way, at least your memories, their experience may be better, and certainly the memories of the people who go through the experience with them will be better.
All right, let's go next on the phone to Kimberly in Dallas. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead.
My question for your guest is, does she cover in her book the importance of mental health and perhaps how caregivers might be able to advocate for their elderly loved one about the importance of treatment of mental health, particularly with, you know, a generation that maybe medication for anxiety or depression maybe wasn't as widely known or done when they were younger, but is, you know, we've taken a lot of steps and moved forward to be able to offer a lot of treatments in those areas now.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Yes, my mother was on antidepressants during the last 5 or 7 years of her life because she was such a stressed caregiver. And I think it's very important. It's not a major focus of my book. My book is more focused on social relationships and community and sort of getting through this medical system. And ironically, there are a number of antidepressants and other drugs that are very helpful earlier in life that are actually very risky as people get older because our bodies don't clear drugs as rapidly from the system. So you have this problem of polypharmacy and multiple medications that people don't, you know, one person doesn't know all the medications the person's on. So there are, you know, some antidepressants create fall risk, for example. Others, sleeping pills that make you groggy and drowsy can have devastating effects in promoting dementia. So there's something called the Beers List, which is put out by the Geriatric Society every year or so. It has the lists of all the drugs that are dangerous for the elderly, promote falls, promote confusion, and it has alternatives that are much safer. But I'm a big fan for looking at the 5-cent solutions first. You know, start with the thing that has the lowest risk and then only escalate slowly from there. I'm a big fan of therapy, of all forms of support groups. But I think you've got to be actually more careful as people age with drug interventions than you do when people are younger.
All right, next on the phone to Adela in Austin. Hi, Adela.
Hello?
Hi, are you with us? Go right ahead, please.
Yes. Well, no, my question is I would like to see what how she addresses the issue of to choose your time of death, like it's been doing in the West Coast of the United States with some information about that.
I do address it. It's not a major focus of the book, but I think it's 64 million Americans now have access to the ability to time their deaths if they are terminally ill. So the entire West Coast and scattered places in the middle and on the East Coast. I think my personal feeling is this is an option that some people are going to want. But it's not going to solve the peculiar problems of modern death for most people. There are lots and lots of people. The people who actually like this idea tend to be people who've had high control over their lives and they want high control over their deaths. Hmm. But for most of us are kind of in a middle ground. And also, this goes back through history. Louis Pasteur actually participated in the mercy killing of 5 farmers who had been bitten by a rabid wolf in the 1800s. So there's a long tradition, much longer than we realize, of mercy killing of various forms or people pleading for enough opium to soothe their symptoms. So it's not as new as we think it is, but I don't think it's a solution for most people. I want to see us have much better coordinated healthcare systems, bring back medical care at home, take care of all the people in the middle who are more in the position of saying, well, I don't want to go on dialysis, but my kids are trying to force me into it because they just can't let go of me. Most of us are not going to access aid in dying, but I do discuss it, and I do think aid in dying can be as meaningful and as dignified a death as any other, and it can also be as undignified as any other.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I wonder, Katie, if in your experience it is helpful to the dying person if the people who love that person most are able to accept that they're about to die.
I can't think of a greater gift to give someone you love than to accept that they are on the pathway to dying and to imagine and create supports so that can be the best possible experience ever. When my friend's mother was dying of ovarian cancer, she was able to say to her mother, "Would you like to listen to Frank Sinatra on the headphones?" And she said she will never forget the look on her mother's face as she put those headphones on her mom so she could hear her favorite singer. When people do not come to terms with the approach of death, family members. They do things that may be loving, but they're not kind. They insist on interventions and drugs and you know, diagnostic tests that are painful and disturbing to the dying person. And they don't actually achieve anything. And then the result after the death is over is that family members are left with a great deal of regret that they didn't, that they clung so tight, that they couldn't see what was coming, and that they then put people through what some doctors and nurses sometimes call torture. I mean, that's the expression that ICU nurses and doctors often use to describe what they feel they're putting people through when a family member or a member of the medical team can't let go. But again, I think we need to start thinking about this so much earlier than we do. This is not something to try to come to terms with during that last panic call to 911 and that trip to the ER. This is something to talk about 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, to express our thankfulness to the people that we love. I mean, I think we should take these occasions like the 70th birthday or the 80th birthday or the 50th wedding anniversary. You know, don't wait for your eulogy to hear all the nice things that people want to say about you, and don't deprive them of the opportunity of saying them before you die. Because I think if we can come to peace emotionally with the fact that there is going to be this void in our lives, we are going to miss dearly these people that we love, if we can sort of anticipate that ahead of time and come to peace with it, we might be able to be much wiser and much more savvy when those final crises hit.
You say we should understand that the goal here is not perfection.
Yes. Modern death is a mess. The systems are broken when people are in the realm of the unfixable. And that means that no matter how conscientious a daughter or son you are, or no matter how well you plan for your own decline, things are likely to go wrong. And I think we need to be very self-forgiving, very self-understanding, and realize this is definitely a perfection-free zone.
The new book by journalist Katie Butler is called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Katie, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
That was absolutely wonderful, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can use any podcast app that you're familiar with to subscribe to the Think podcast. And you can learn about shows we have planned for the days in the immediate future at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.